Okay, go ahead again.
Testing for level, 1-2.
That's great, yeah. Okay. Now, the basic thing I want to get, and I'll give you a couple of examples of ones I've done,
mm-hmm.
so you'll see how what I've done. I'll bring that down mm-hmm. tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah.
So you can go along, and it helps to maybe start, you're telling me you came from New York. Were you born in New York?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was born in New York, in the Bronx, and brought up, I think, probably had a rather distinctly different kind of childhood or background, but my parents were Finnish stock. My mother was born in the United States, and actually my father just missed being born in the United States by about 6 months. Was brought over to Montana at that age, and my mother was born in Worcester, Massachusetts, but both of them had returned to Finland with their parents, and then they'd come back. And the urban Finns, the young couples, very often would get together through their associations or something like that, and form cooperatives. And one of the things they did was, in the larger cities, was to get band together and buy an apartment house, a co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was way back in what time? I mean,
well, this was in the 20s, but it really started much earlier, you know, the 1900, 1910 period.
Yeah.
My grandfather had been active in organizing co-ops. Finn did that. So I grew up in a Finnish cooperative house in the Bronx in a Jewish neighborhood. And there were about 72 families there, and the nearest other house was several miles away. And the sort of cultural center of the Finnish community for us was Finn Hall in Harlem, which was 127th Street and 5th Avenue. And there was a Finnish repertory theater, a community theater. My mother and my aunt acted in. My father took care of the light. They had dances there, they had classes, and athletic league, a real panoply of activities. And I went to public school. One of the things about that, of course, is I was born just before the Depression in 1928. And my father had been working at Bell Labs and lost that job and then essentially mm-hmm. was unemployed except for odd labor during the Depression. And most of the Finnish families, therefore, to survive, didn't have children. There were only, I think, 8 children in the 72 families, so we sort of constituted a family. And I was, of course, the oldest and the older brother, so I was always sort of responsible for the others. But that was rather interesting. And
you were born in 28?
March 6th, 1928,
mm-hmm.
The year before the big crash. I don't remember anything about the big mm-hmm. crash. I do remember my father going off to work at a suit in a Hamburg and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think he held a job until probably 33 or 34,
awesome.
Something awesome. Like that. And, but certainly, you know, growing up in that kind of a situation colored my background always. My mother took care of the books for the co-op, and there would be a meeting, the monthly meeting at our apartment. I remember the discussions, and there's always a sort of responsibility for the broader community, or taking part in things like that was always built in. And that was very true of the Jewish community, too. You had the workman's circle, the Arbeiterring, very active there, and it was a working class neighborhood, but very sort of socially conscious. They voted for Roosevelt in 36, I remember that, and later.
Mm-hmm.
And very conscious of happenings abroad, the rise of fascism, the Spanish Civil War, the war in China.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that picture of the little Chinese child in the bombed railroad station just crying? That made a terrific impression on me. I can remember the movie tone news of the bombing of the Panay, for example. I suppose as a child, I was very much more exposed to what was happening in the world than a lot of kids in the rest of the country. And I remember our mayor, Fiorello LaGuardia, the little flower, mm-hmm. reading the comics on the thing. But there was a very political consciousness and also a feeling that, you know, we had to do what we could, and through the co-op and stores and mm-hmm. school, organizing and working together just to survive the Depression. So I think that had a lot to do with my life.
That sort of influenced your whole life, I would
say. Yeah. I think it very much did. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate. I had a certain talent for doodling. And from my neighborhood school, I went to the High School of Music and Art, which was a citywide selective school that chose kids not on the basis of pass of grades or IQ or stuff, but certain talent. Two kids from every junior high neighborhood. So it was a very mixed, we had a black student body president in 1943. Mm. Kenny White, I remember. And one of my classmates, a very gorgeous looking black girl.
Hello.
Hello.
You have a key?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, as long as you just turn it off. Will you get your...
Yeah,
thanks. I really appreciate that.
Hey. So, flipped my mind. Oh, she married Henry Belafonte. It was his first.
Oh,
it was very funny.
Mm-hmm. Now, who was this? This was Mrs.
Her name was Gloria, and she was a classmate. There were quite a number of them. One of my classmates, surprisingly enough, I didn't find out till later, whom I had gone always to school with, was J. Rabinowitz's older brother, who stayed in New York and taught art at Columbia.
Mm.
Here I knew the Rabinowitzes when they first came up here in all these years, and I didn't discover it until they had a housewarming, and I saw his painting over there, and I recognized the style.
Mm-hmm.
So, I went there in 1940, and of course during the war years, that's a very...
What was the name of that school again, the New York School?
No, High School of Music and Art. It was the academic school. The performing arts was the trade school in art.
Okay.
And the two have now been combined.
Ah, that's right.
In the LaGuardia High School of Fine and Performing Arts. But I remember odd things. Like when I was very small, we went to live in upstate New York for a while on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was after my father lost his job. And my mother's Uncle Otterby, had a farm we stayed on for up near Trumansburg in a little crossroads called Podunk. And those years were very, very made a great impression on me. I ran into a number of the people from that area later up in Alaska. They apparently in the late 30s, when farming just went up the tube, moved up to Alaska to go mining. That includes the Lofties, Lakeys, Katuris, Utilas, Gus Utila, and Rossanders, and others that you run into around here. And I can remember incidents like the farmers blockading the road and dumping milk, the milk strike.
Wow, and that was in the 30s?
In the 30s, something like that. And that kind of activity going on. And my parents, when they had money, had bought a little quarter-acre lot in... about 50 miles out of the city, and they built this little summer place there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go up there, either by train or driving. And we built had a sauna there. All of my parents' friends helped them build it. There's one Finnish fellow who was a stonemason and made monuments for what? Mount Hope Cemetery. I can't remember any. The one just outside of the Bronx. And he received these the marble from Vermont in very stout wooden crates. So he just took those apart and saved the lumber, and that was the main part of the sauna. And a lot of our friends who are construction workers came up, and the whole thing went up in about a week. And I can remember the sort of dedication of the first sauna we had in our own sauna. Of course, you know, when I was younger, we went to Otterby sauna or to others, or even I remember a sauna in the city, which didn't go to after about 5 years old, but in the Finnish part of Harlem. The Finns were moved into Harlem before the First World War, about the same time as the blacks, and there never were as many of them. And they didn't, since they tended to buy individual houses, co-op houses, they tended to be scattered, and then you'd have some center like the Finn Hall that they went to. And, after the war, in 1948, I went to Finland with the American Friends Service Committee, which was really a formative experience in itself, too. A group of young people, we built our own camp and lived there and went out. We'd start out with a silent meeting in the morning and then go out to work all day helping people build a house, clear land or something like that. We ran a unit, refugees from the area that Russia took over. Essentially, most of the province of Karelia was taken over by Russia. There were some 450,000 people there. I think nine or so people stayed, and everybody else moved into the rest of Finland. And so that my family also, I guess a lot of people from immigrant backgrounds had sort of work ethic, and I know I never could live up to my father's idea of what should be enough work. You know, very interesting. When he was younger, I guess he used to read science fiction, Hugo Gernsback. When I was about 10 or 11 years old, he introduced me to a story, The Man in the Moon, which he had read in the 20s. It was reprinted, and it introduced me to science fiction, and he ever after regretted that he had done that, because I was an avid reader, you know. Eventually, you know, why do you want to read all those books all the time? I think my unemployment and sort of disappointment, and my father so I remember him as a younger man, you know, helping me make model airplanes and things like that. But later it was just work and work. He became very serious and very, I don't think, essentially very happy person because of that. You know, long. And having been what would have been an electronics tech and practically an electrical engineer, and then to end up finally to work back to being a journeyman electrician, I mean, getting work at that era after years of odd jobs or janitorial work or something like that was very, very bitter for him.
I think it does that to a lot of people.
Right. Mm-hmm. Although my mother was perfectly, she worked hard and was good at whatever she did. She picked up work as a domestic, and she had done that when she came back from Finland in 1922. And both my grandparents had my grandmother's mm-hmm. had been. She used to take me to work with her. I remember one place where she had fairly steady employment, the Thaws mm-hmm. on Park Avenue. They had one of these three-story apartments, and she would set me to polishing silver or something, and, you know, mm-hmm. behind the swinging doors, just like upstairs, downstairs. Mm-hmm. But during the day, I would sometimes sneak upstairs to the young master's quarter. I think they had two sons. And I remember these shelves of Britain's toy soldiers. I don't mean one set. I mean an entire wall of these mm-hmm. things. And I remember at this time I could buy penny candy, which came in a tube with a lithographed mm-hmm. picture of a soldier. That was my army. But I could never accumulate as many of those things mm-hmm. as this boy had them, just of those Britons soldiers, which, I don't know, they were, even in those days, they were a dollar a piece or something. Hand-painted, had movable arms and figures. And also remember the master bedroom there, where there was a ticker tape machine with a bright brass trash can by it, so
this was after the Depression?
No, this was during the Depression. I mean, this is a really interesting mm-hmm. sort of thing. So, and of course, not all the people that my mother worked for were that well off. One of them was Dr. Arthur Roberts, who was assistant superintendent of schools in New York. And they lived rather modestly. I don't think superintendents of schools in those days were paid quite as grandly as they are mm-hmm. today. But, you know, they could afford to have someone come in mm-hmm. and cook once a week and help clean up the apartment. And Mrs. Roberts, I remember, was very... Both of them were, you know, liked to have me there. It wasn't at all like the Thaws, where you had to be invisible. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was more than a 3 or 4 room apartment. But they had books, and I got into reading. And when Dr. Roberts died, Mrs. Roberts gave his books, including Woodrow Wilson's History of the American People and all of those, to my mother for me.
Oh, no.
So even as a little kid, and I don't remember how old I was reading stuff like that. Mm.
Oh.
One of the interesting things is teaching later, I began to think about how kids learn, and I did believe very much in the phonic method until I went in to one of my fellow teachers who was from Texas, and she was telling the children to remember to pronounce the ah as in baya, and I began to wonder about that. And then I remembered that my mother used to read me the comics, and I remember, I have a very vivid memory of Flash Gordon mm-hmm. Coming into the New York Journal American, the first paper at that time. And that's the first few chapters, because the comet was coming to destroy the Earth. You know, and I was very terrified of things like that when I was 4 or 5 mm-hmm. years old. Worried about the fate of the Earth in 25 million years.
And here you are again.
Right. But, and I remember that I began to pick up English words, but I couldn't speak English when I went to kindergarten. So I flunked kindergarten.
Mm-hmm. You spoke Finnish at home?
I spoke Finnish at home.
And
my grandmother spoke Finnish, and mm-hmm. you know, the other families in the house spoke Finnish. We went to Finn Hall, the plays mm-hmm. weren't finished, the dances weren't finished. I picked up enough of the other language in the neighborhood to go shopping. It turned mm-hmm. out to be Yiddish, however. Mm-hmm. I spoke Yiddish and Finnish when I went to public school. That didn't cut it, and I had to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that I was about 8 or 9 years old before I could pronounce the difference between shoulder and soldier in mm-hmm. Finnish, because Finnish doesn't have consonant blends. It has diphthong vowel blends, but consonants mm-hmm. are simple consonants. You don't have any sh sound. You can't. They both come out solder in Finnish.
Mm-hmm.
Big deal. But anyway, going back to that, I realized when I recapitulated that and tried to think of it that I had learned to read English long before I could pronounce it. Long before I could speak it. I could understand mm-hmm. it and I could mm-hmm. read it. And eventually, I thought it was about 4 or 5 years old that I'd first been treated to that. I don't think I read it but I had a kind of memory. Mm-hmm. I could remember words and pick them up later. I think that helped. I could carry the visual image in mm-hmm. my mother's explanation of what it was.
But you don't. I don't think kids learn phonetically. Very. I mean, maybe some do.
A lot of people think it is, but
it
isn't.
But I don't know what it is. But it almost seems like it's just suddenly they catch.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I, you know.
The thing that struck me is I later found out that Flash Gordon first appeared in August 1931.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought I was 3 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
When I first realized that those symbols meant words.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that I could read at mm-hmm. 3 years old, but that was the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even 6 years later, well, 5 years later, I couldn't speak the language. I could pick out the words. And
how did you manage in school?
I picked it. I mean, mm-hmm. I did fine. I could read. I could read from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't very well pronounce what I was reading.
Well, I imagine at that time there were a lot of kids of different ethnic backgrounds with the same difficulties.
Oh, yeah. And the typical accent in PS 82 was sort of New York Jewish accent, mm-hmm. but there were Catholic Irish kids, and there was a Chinese kid, and one black kid, and actually the whole Chinese family,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. So that was. Yeah, and that was the great thing about New York. You always heard different accents and different languages mm-hmm. on the. I got to be quite a mimic, but the hardest accent for me to pick up was Finnish.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, 20 or more before I could mimic one of my Finnish compatriots. I could pick up any other accent, whether it was East Indian, Jamaican, mm-hmm. or Chinese, American, Jewish. I was very good on different accents.
mm-hmm.
But the one that was used by the people around me was the hardest one to mimic, and I never could figure out exactly why, although I can do it now.
Well, how long did you stay in New York then? Did you go right through school, basically, then? You did, because you went through the high school for...
Went through high school, graduated in 40, and I went to work... No, I graduated in 44, January 45, fall of 44. Went to work in Eastern Co-op Wholesale.
Eastern what?
Cooperative Wholesale. It was a food wholesale for the cooperative stores. Mm-hmm. I was an office machine repairman. I did artwork for their mm-hmm. displays and flyers. I eventually transferred to the warehouse where I was, got a little more money and harder work. And then I went to Finland in 48. Mm-hmm. With the French Service Committee, came back and worked for Church World Service in their warehouse for a while. Went to Cooper Union Night School in mm-hmm. Civil Engineering.
That was in New York.
And that was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And went then to Ohio and admitted to Antioch College in spring of 49. The only problem was, it turned out they wanted money.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have it. And the only scholarships available were the GI Bill, and I was a conscientious objector, so I didn't have that. I had won the New York State Regents Scholarship, and I almost mm-hmm. went to Syracuse to study forestry, but I didn't. There was a young lady who I was much smitten with who went to Antioch, and I mm-hmm. liked Antioch, and I knew the people involved there had gotten involved through the friends
mm-hmm.
with the Morgan family, who were the son and... the sons of Arthur Morgan, who had brought the work-study program. And I was a great believer in work-study programs,
mm-hmm.
rather than
mm-hmm.
entirely a didactic approach, which mm-hmm. most schools in those days had. And so I was also active in the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a religious pacifist group, and on a Committee of Racial Equality, which was run by a fellow named Jim Farmer, who's a big black guy. And took part in some of the sit-ins and things we had in the 40s. People forget that actually, you know, the civil rights movement has been continuous in one form or another since, I would say, at least since the days of John Woolman. among friends. The 17th century, there's always a threat of continuity. And the nonviolent sit-in and other tactics came directly out of the religious pacifist element in the civil rights movement in the 40s, during the war. Mm-hmm. We had a threatened march on Washington to get Fair Employment Practices Commission set up and all that, and to integrate the armed forces. So what came later was, you know, it was just a sort of rebirth and re-efflorescence, and that involved many of the same people. But anyway, the result was I went to Wilberforce, which was a black college. I was the first white graduate of Wilberforce College.
Where was Wilberforce?
Oh, 7 miles away from Antioch.
Oh, right.
I wanted to stay in a close relationship with the young lady in question. Who thereupon met somebody else, and then I met my...
The biggest moves were made on the stage.
Right. So I went to a square dance and twisted my ankle, and another young lady went and got an ace bandage, and that turned out to be Joan, whom I did marry and come up to Alaska.
So after you graduated from Wilberforce, what did you do then? And you came right to Alaska?
Straight to Alaska, yeah. Actually, I didn't even wait around for graduation. We got married and came to Alaska. We were going together for about 2 years before that.
Mm-hmm.
Joan didn't complete her. So we bought a Dodge Power Wagon in Xenia, Ohio, and drove it to the east, and we were married at Cambridge Friends Meeting under the joint care of the Yellow Springs Friends Meeting, which we had joined, and Cambridge, to which Joan's mother belonged, and loaded it up and headed
had
around the country.
Had you had that idea in the back of your mind for some time? Or
Oh, yeah. It probably, golly, I don't remember when it sort of first occurred to me as one of many thousand alternatives, mm-hmm. probably when I was about 5 or 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the plays at Finn Hall, many of them dealt with sort of pioneer farming. Finland was not just a rural country, but it wasn't a country of peasants. It was a country much like Alaska, very thinly settled with people going out.
Mm.
So there's a continual theme of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Were your parents Quakers then, or did that
something
you found on your own after?
Right. Essentially, I met the friends when I was working at the co-op wholesale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Although I knew friends through my church activity, I've been brought up and confirmed in the Finnish Evangelical Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm.
But because of my high school activities, I got active with the New York Christian Youth Council, which
mm-hmm.
was largely Methodist, but there were other groups.
Mm-hmm.
And that got me into trouble with the pastor. The Finnish Evangelical Church, Lutheran Church, was very conservative. They didn't, the only activity young people could have was going to Sunday school. Once a year, we'd have a strawberry festival, which means we could sit around and eat strawberry chocolate. I mean, it's shortcake. And you're not supposed to dance, and our entire young youth group always went to Finn Hall for the dances. Our sort of password for any activity was, what would the pastor say? And then we'd all giggle.
Mm-hmm.
And Pastor Viskari was a very nice man, but a very unworldly man. But I took the Bible and much of the teaching very seriously, especially the emphasis on individual responsibility. And I decided that essentially the Christian message was that we were to attempt to be, at least in our personal line, to be pacifist, that you have to take responsibility for your actions, and that includes not killing somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's some place where the Lutherans really get sort of hoist on their own petard, because it was a sort of yes, but, you know, you're supposed to
mm-hmm.
go along with the powers that's ordained by God, which is the state, and if they tell you, then you're home free, and I didn't agree with that. And anyway, I was going around with others, like the Methodists and so on, that the pastor recited, you know, be ye yoked not unequally with unbelievers. And I guess others were unbelievers. And they'd wanted to send me to seminary. They had all kinds of ambitions in mind for me. But I'm just as glad that didn't turn out. And so...
Well, to be a conscientious objector in those days must have been rather uncommon and unpopular, was it? And,
actually, there were quite a number. There were about 25,000 religious objectors, Quakers and Brethren, Mennonites, the smoke jumpers, that, for example, were called the pacifist paratroops because they were all, you know, farm boy pacifists, a lot of people. I was willing to serve as a non-combatant, but I had a local draft board, local board 22, Ogden Avenue, Bronx, New York, working class neighborhood. And it has made up of the chaplain of the Jewish war veterans, the chaplain of the Italian war veterans. You had all these chaplains on it. And here I got, you know, this kid shows up arguing theology. And in our neighborhood, you're not supposed to even be able to pronounce conscientious objector, much less be one.
Mm-hmm.
So, they weren't about to... I guess they were affronted, you know. Rather than putting me in the army in a non-combatant status, they were determined to turn my head around. And I, stubborn Finn, the more they argued, stubborner I got, and the more extreme position I went to. Rather than giving in, I just went the other way, to the point of tearing up my draft card and mailing it back to them. They threatened me with all kinds of things, and the more they threatened me, the less I believed that they were taking a moral stand. They were going to send me to jail, but fine, which upset them, because that made their records look bad. So they never really settled my case until I got to be 35 years old, and I was on it. It was very funny. I mean, ultimately, it was hysterical, because, I had finally figured out that they really didn't want their statistics to reflect the fact that anybody from the neighborhood was a conscientious objector. Mm-hmm. There were several other COs whom they let off on physical grounds. One of my friends had asthma. It wasn't that uncommon, even among the Jewish kids, it wasn't that uncommon when you, those who were concerned with the moral questions.
Mm-hmm.
And especially after the war and the A-bomb, the American rattling A-bomb around the world, it became more common. But it wasn't popular. I remember one of my communist acquaintances socking me in the nose when he heard that, because he was back in the closing days of the war. The communists in those days were 100% patriots. People forget that. It was very funny. But my parents backed me up, and it's interesting. I found out that my mother's father had been a conscientious objector. He had left Finland to avoid service in the Tsar's army, and he was a. When I met him ultimately, he's a very good old gentleman. I think my mother's position always was that.
Mm-hmm. Sort of
a Christian socialist position.
Yeah, I think that usually things like this, the idea is, the seed sort of is planted somewhere a long time before you actually do something and realize that is how you think. And it's interesting to trace back to where it comes.
I think it comes from family attitudes. I don't think they're ever expressed.
I tend to think that the most important values that we hold in life are the ones that were never really expressed as you're growing up, but somehow, without being verbalized, want to lie or hurt your fellow man. And it just seems you never remember actually being talked about around the.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think that, I think, the Lutheran Church has really very little impression on me other than sort of intellectually sharpen. It certainly set out the differences as well as the agreements. very sharply.
But the family influence was much greater.
Yeah.
And then the unspoken family.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And, well, I think, you know, also the general, the Finnish community I grew up in, where people did help each other and look out mm-hmm. for each other, kids, and where it was a great deal of volunteerism and mm-hmm. a great deal of mutual support. I mean, you know, our sauna was built by everybody and mm-hmm. used by mm-hmm. everybody, for example. People shared what they had.
So when you came up to Alaska, you had all this behind you. Did you have any idea of what sort of lifestyle you wanted? Did you have an idea of communal life?
Pioneer, you were going to homestead, you know, mm-hmm. clear and cultivated, back to the land, mm-hmm. but also did want to, you know, take part in the life of the community. We hadn't figured on staying in Fairbanks. We were looking for a smaller rural area, as I said, Chitna or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly had some, you know, general ideas. I did want to, you know, if I found other people to form a friends meeting, which we did ultimately, and this interest in cooperatives, and we formed some. The only successful one was what's now the Northern Schools Federal Credit Union. That was one of my
mm-hmm.
things. I was the organizing spirit behind the credit mm-hmm. union. We had the homesteaders co-op and things like that, which we purchased in common, but that fell apart when farming fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And there was I was active in, when I worked for the mining company, I was...
When did you work for the mining company? You came up here and you
from 1952 through about...
Oh, when you first got up here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I worked first in the power plant as a condenser plugger in the basement mm-hmm. of that, and then worked later as a electrician's helper and a line crew.
That was why you were trying to clear the land and
right.
do all the
mm-hmm.
things, build the house and
right.
raise a family and farm at the same time, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All in a copious free time.
Yeah.
And I remember I started out at 97 cents an hour the first year. And mm-hmm. Well, I guess 3 years later when we parted company with the company, I was getting, I think, $1.97 an hour. Construction electrician in those days were getting $5 an hour, but I would have had to leave town, you know,
mm-hmm.
I
mm-hmm.
wouldn't do that. And I worked for the university, and that was fairly good wages. I think it was 2.5 or something.
So when did you decide to go back? Because you become a teacher, you were involved in teaching.
Well, we got when the Friends meeting was organized,
mm-hmm.
Actually one of the things that some of the Friends were interested in was a Friends community. I remember
mm-hmm.
we went down to Suslota in the mountains and looked at that and Caribou Creek. The problem was those of us who were up here all were already bound for the places we were
mm-hmm.
in. But we were interested in a Friends school, and a number of, Phyllis Brown and Connie Griffith and I all went to school originally with the idea that we would get our teacher certificate so that we could run a school. In those days, the standards for setting up a private school were much stricter than they are today.
Mm-hmm.
And but we all ended up teaching in the public school.
Mm-hmm.
And we taught in the days of Jim Ryan, who was the superintendent of schools and a very good man. He had been the head of the Department of Education and the coach of the university basketball team, and then for 10 years he'd been commissioner of education for Greening.
Mm-hmm.
He had figured out how to the tobacco tax scheme to provide funds for building schools in Alaska. He had started the move to integrate the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the public school long before anyone else. And had actually managed to bring some into the territorial system.
Had you gone outside then to get your teaching certificate?
No, I went to University of Alaska here.
Uh-huh.
UAF. I'd been working for the university as an electrician. I took courses on the side, and then I dropped out and I started teaching. And I couldn't get electrical work in the summer. I did the one summer, and then I got into surveying and reorganized the surveyors union. I was vice president of that. When I worked for the mining company, the FE company, which we used to call the School of Hard Knocks up here. Everybody had to graduate from the United States Smelting, Refining, and Mining Company. And I really enjoyed that. It was hard, dirty work, but working on the line crew and an electric crew, both, I got out to every one of the dredges and dredge camps. I really saw a lot more of the country. And then being the grievance man for the union, I got to know people, especially if they had grievances. But on a number of different levels, so it wasn't just sticking to the to the job. And we lived out at Olness for the first summer, and there was primarily a whole bunch of old Finns out there. Well, that was interesting too. And we went to Herman Mackey's sauna every Saturday night, and Herman had built his sauna in 1907, and it was open to everybody in the valley, and everybody in the valley went to Herman's for a sauna, just like our sauna, and that had been going on since 1907. It was considerably longer than the Chena Ridge sauna.
When did you start your sauna?
53.
Gosh, that was just a year, 2 years after you got up here, 1 year after you got up here.
No, 53, 54.
So then you
We had to haul water, for one thing. I mean, a sauna was a necessity. There were something like four commercial saunas in Fairbanks in those days.
Yes, that's right.
You either went out to Fox and hauled back 50-gallon drums of water or jerry cans of water, or you went to the university if you had connections and filled up your thing there. But, Pioneer Wells didn't deliver out there because they couldn't get up the hill. Nobody had anything to store Pioneer Wells water in anyway until about 5 or 6 years later. And the sauna was very much a necessity. And one time on Chena Ridge, you could go to sauna just about at somebody's house on a different night. We staggered the night. So that, except I think Tuesday and Wednesday, maybe two nights a week. Friday nights we went over to Miller Hill to Bill Perry's sauna. Saturday was at Ben Zeller's, Thursday was up at Holman's, Mondays were at Kegler's.
Everybody kept clean.
Yeah.
I could see
also,
that.
Also, great way to keep warm.
Oh, yes, more importantly.
Yeah.
Right. How did you find, how did you find political, emotional climate for you? I mean, it was in those days. Was it what you had expected, or did you have a chance to even think
I
about
don't
it?
Remember what I expected. Yeah. I didn't have it was a very funny, it was like being in a time warp. In some ways it was like the 30s or the 20s with the wooden sidewalks and the unions just being organized, and stuff like that. And they'd just gotten over the miners' strike. The miners' co-op, which was had just closed. It was very stimulating, very open atmosphere, and then people from all over the place. It was really a great place. It still is, but and at that time, my goodness, what did we have? 8,000 or 9,000 people, and we had Symphony Orchestra with Joe Fayish as the first fiddle, and I don't remember who was the second fiddle, but two string section. But and I remember when Joan's brother and his friends, including Roger Payne, who later chased Whale, came up here straight out of high school. There was a music festival, and they had a French horn quartet made up of. Let's say there's Mrs. Bork, and there was one of the McIntosh twins, and a GI from base. But they, how frequently do you find a French horn quartet? And you had all kinds of interest in theater, Mm-hmm. Salisbury was just coming up here, but there had always been. This is one of the stimulating.
Oh yes, I understand that. Interviewing all these people, that's very interesting.
You had the Adler's bookstore and Don Adler, who was one of the New York Adlers, the very much the dandy, you know, three-piece suit and a boutonniere and a cane every day in Fairbanks on wooden sidewalks. But you know, a very intellectual old gentleman. And the old timers were, you know, they were dull or ground down. Didn't matter where they were from. I know one old guy with real big mustaches. He, you know, I'm from the Caucasus. You know, old. I don't know what, whether he was an Azerbaijani or. But anyway, you know, he worked on the mines. Yeah. Tremendous mixture of people who had come in. Many of the old timers who were immigrants came directly to Alaska. They sort of crossed the continent and headed up to Alaska. And you had people from Canada and very much consciousness of the North as a unit, the Yukon, and this, you know, the borders were artificial. And people were well read. Terrifically well read. And everybody wrote poetry, you know, word doodles. But there was, you know, I mean, what, a guy on the dredge, an oiler, a greasy oiler on the dredge, he'd write poetry, felt like it. You know, there was none of this feeling, a division of life. Everybody could do everything, didn't matter what. They could paint a portrait. Well, it wasn't the best, but they could do it. One of the things that Joan used to say, which I think really suited the situation, anything worth doing is worth doing badly. You know, why wait for perfection? Do it. And that's the way it was.
I think it still is. Too
Oh, yeah, that survived. That, it has been dented somewhat by the sort of, you know, television and the flood of newer people who came up during the pipeline. But it was, you know, sharing of experiences. You couldn't walk along the road without somebody stopping to pick you up. You couldn't starve to death so long as somebody had a moose. You know, that was, and everybody worked terrifically hard.
Oh, I imagine so.
Just sort of charged energy the whole thing.
So then you taught school, and later weren't you superintendent of schools? It seems to me it was rumored to me that you weren't you superintendent of schools at some time?
No, that was much later. I went. I never was superintendent of schools. I was director of research and planning for the school district. In 62, I went back outside, and we all went outside. We went out in an overloaded horse. We hauled a horse, dog, five kids. All our gear. I'd been admitted. I wanted to finish graduate school the year at London School had whetted my appetite.
Now, when did you go to London School?
1958-59.
Oh, so you'd gone out again to London School. Oh,
right.
Okay,
and I worked in anthropology, and I did my field work down in the Copper River country. But Joan couldn't take going back over to England with five kids. So I applied elsewhere, and I got a number of admissions. Both times I'd been admitted to McGill, and I never accepted McGill's offers. But Harvard had a different thing, which was an education, and but it was applying some of the techniques I'd learned in anthropology to education. It was in educational administration, research, and planning. And they offered a full, essentially $25,000 a year, which in those days was pretty good.
Oh, gosh.
So I took that and went out. And we bought a little place in Wayland, Massachusetts, and I commuted in. It's a very heavily supported program by grants from private grants from foundations. There were just roughly 10 students, and there were about 10 faculty members. And we worked in a very collegial kind of setting, and much the first year was didactic and a bit of field work, and the rest of it was all field work,
mm-hmm.
working with school districts and in different kinds of problems, real life problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I was selected also to be an editor of the Harvard Educational Review, and I did that for 3 years while mm-hmm. I was there, too. One of the board of editors, book review editor for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting, right? Because we took it from a circulation of about 6,000 to 18,000,
wow.
you know, worked on making it, you know, mm-hmm. bringing out real live problems and making it mm-hmm. something that everybody read. And it was also the Kennedy-Johnson years. Dean Keppel, mm-hmm. Frank Keppel, was dean of the school. We worked very closely with him on, the kinds of programs theoretically the federal government could do. And then Kennedy was elected, and mm-hmm. he went to be Commissioner of Education. And many of the suggestions that our group had made became the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and all that.
Oh, that's very exciting.
So, mm-hmm. and Head Start and, mm-hmm. and those kind of programs. A large part of my later work at Harvard, I stayed there as a faculty member in the program for 3 years.
I see, that where you got your doctorate?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was assistant director for the Center for Field Studies. And then the director accepted a contract to work with Vietnam, Republic of South Vietnam, on their secondary school program. And I refused. I wouldn't work with Vietnam. So I applied to come back to Alaska, and I was accepted as a principal at Barnett School. It's interesting. Vince Conroy is a very dear friend of mine at Harvard, who was the director and had taken it. Got a team together, which included a number of people from the University of Michigan. I would have been with him. And they were traveling around Vietnam during the monsoon season, looking at the schools, and going into the airport at Da Nang, they hit the mountain. I would have been on that airplane if I... Mm-hmm. But Barnett was the downtown school. It had the poorer neighborhoods, and so it was one where I could get money for federal programs. Dar Southall was the nurse there, and we started the first breakfast program for poorer kids. We started the Head Start program that summer in the school district originally. Darrellyn Merritt, who was a gym teacher, we picked to run it.
Mm-hmm.
And then later we made it a community-based program. But that was the first Head Start
mm-hmm.
program in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the things I was able to bring back. And then I became principal of University
mm-hmm.
Park
mm-hmm.
for 2 years. And then I was director of research and planning and federal programs for the district.
Mm-hmm.
And I got about $8 or $9 million a year out of federal funds
mm-hmm.
for the
mm-hmm.
school district. And, but it was programs like that. And we were able to find funding also for other things, you know, besides the school district and the borough through that, you know, crisis line and a number of those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Get them started. Also worked with some of the native groups on a volunteer base. So it was a very busy time in that regard. But of course, politically, there was a so-called conservative movement. I remember somebody had recently come. One of the things that happened after statehood is a great movement from the southeastern United States up here. And I think a lot of people came up with the preconception. They'd never heard of Alaska before. It got to be very popular, you know, the statehood thing. And
so
I think also the oil industry beginning to get interested. The first well was struck, I think, 57. And
mm-hmm.
So that was.
So they came bringing.
I remember somebody saying, "We got to have a progressive school system here, like we got down in Tulsa." Didn't think that was quite what we needed, but anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there, His interests, I think in the days of Dr. Ryan and subsequently, we did hold standards high and did have experimental programs looking for results. Subsequently, especially under Chuck Smith, whom I despise, there was the movement, there was a saying we were going to be rigid and saying we were going to save money, but actually it was all bullshit, and
yeah.
It wasn't true at all. The program that we had at University Park, we tested the kids by very good standardized exams on reading level before and after, and the kids who were in the open-ended thing gained a year over the expectations, and the people who had wanted, proof and all, refused to accept. They just couldn't. In other words, it didn't fit their preconception, so it couldn't be so.
That's how the whole world goes.
I know.
In a nutshell, isn't it?
Right. You can use whatever.
People don't see what they don't want to see.
Right. That's very true.
And I think that's why we don't.
So that was a very difficult time. And also, all that work and activity was sort of eating me up and giving me less time at home.
Mm-hmm.
But also, ever since England, Joan had been very unhappy, I guess, 5 kids in a row and all this
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. So it was even going to Harvard was an intellectually good time, but Joan didn't find herself very happy back east. She didn't fit back in. And there were